You can listen to Issues Etc. live and on demand with the new Issues Etc. iPhone and Android app. You can get these apps at our website, issuesetc.org. Give us a call, send us an email, or follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Issues Etc. in the palm of your hand. The new Issues Etc. iPhone and Android app. Download today at issuesetc.org. There's an app for that.
Religious liberty will be protected, and a law that requires free preventive care will not discriminate against women.
Today, the Ninth Circuit of Appeals said to our family and millions of Americans that we are equal under the law.
The dissenting opinion by Judge Smith said very clearly that there is a very rational and legitimate government reason for the protection of marriage between only a man and a woman.
For he took the uncleanness and captivity of all nations upon himself on the cross. He really and truly traded places with us all, that we be set free, the unclean made clean again.
Duluth, Minnesota letter carriers love Issues Etc.
We will simply have to be patient and wait to see whether or not the U.S. Supreme Court will be taking a case that will inevitably come to it regarding California's Prop 8, that is, that voter referendum in California. Now seems like ancient history, where the California voters said that they wanted to restrict marriage in the state of California to one man and one woman. Well, the press and those who have been opponents of Prop 8 have done a pretty effective job of painting opposition to same-sex marriage in California as religious bigotry. And they've even argued in court and so far succeeded in convincing the court that the only possible reason anyone could oppose same-sex marriage in California is because of religious bigotry. Is that true? And what should we hear by way of argument in front of the Supreme Court for a rational basis for banning same-sex marriage, not only in California, but elsewhere as well? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. It's Monday afternoon, February the 13th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to be talking about legal issues surrounding Prop 8 for the first half hour or so of Issues Etc. A little bit later in this hour, Deaconess Pam Nielsen joins us. We'll be talking about the Transfiguration celebrated by many churches this coming Sunday. Pastor Timothy Meck will be with us in the second hour of the program. We'll conclude our three-part series with him on pastors and elders today, working within one's vocation and what kind of accountability should there be between pastors and elders, pastors and their people. Our call-in number for the next 2 hours, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MYIE. We have space at our Facebook fan page for you to list any question or comments you may have on pastors and elders for that hour two conversation. We will be giving away a copy or two of the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February, Pastors and Elders, to the listeners with best questions or comments on that subject in hour two. And you can send us an email on any subject, talkback at issuesetc.org, or a tweet at issuesetc. Dr. Ryan McPherson is a regular guest. He's chair of the History Department at Bethany Lutheran Church in Mankato, Minnesota, president of the Hausvater Project, and he wrote a friend of the court brief for Prop 8 on behalf of Hausvater Project. Dr. McPherson, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you, Todd.
What, as far as you can tell, was the basis for the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decision? How did they arrive at their decision saying that Prop 8 is unconstitutional?
Sure. I think it has to do largely with how the question is framed. Rather than framing it as a question of whether or not the people appropriately exercised their authority under the California Constitution to amend the Constitution by initiative and then count the votes and determine whether or not, you know, enough went for that, they framed the question around this. They said, is it possible for any rational person to desire that civil marriage be defined according to the following 14 words? Only marriage between a man and a woman is valid or recognized in California. Those are the 14 words of Proposition 8, and the court concluded that there is no rational reason to arrive at that conclusion, that religious bigotry is the only explanation The flip side of their argument, that's the way they negate Proposition 8, the way they affirm the same-sex couples who were suing in court, is to say that they are entitled to social dignity, that they, in effect, have a right to self-esteem, and that the courts should exercise authority to ensure that the public protects their self-esteem by allowing them to be granted the title marriage.
So, in essence, we're to the first part of that explanation, were the opponents of Prop 8 arguing in court that all opposition to same-sex marriage, in principle, is irrational?
That's certainly the tone of it. Now, in legalese, you have to understand that the phrase rational basis is a particular term that the courts use, and it's called the rational basis test. And so basically it's this. In order for a piece of legislation to be allowed and to be regarded as constitutional, it needs to pass a rational basis test. And so, in other words, there needs to be at least some rational reason why a legislature, or in this case the people through the initiative process, could conceivably enact that policy. And that's considered a fairly simple test. There's also a higher test known as the heightened scrutiny test. And the opponents of Proposition 8 tried to have the court apply that one as well. The heightened scrutiny test requires not only that you show a rational basis, but also that you show, for example, that it's the least restrictive means of doing that, and that it reduces harm in particular to minorities, that it takes their concerns to heart. And the court, both at the district court level and in the Ninth Circuit, attempted to apply also that level. But Judge Walker's decision for the district court just came out and said flat out that Proposition 8 didn't even meet the lower standard of rational basis. Therefore, the heightened scrutiny, of course, it doesn't meet that either, because that's a rational basis plus more. And the Ninth Circuit essentially echoed what Walker said.
Now, I guess what I'm wondering here is, when the court made this decision, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, what did they have to, I'm looking for a better word, but I can't find one. What did they have to ignore to arrive at their conclusion?
Well, I think what they had to ignore was the principal arguments that were advanced by the proponents for Proposition 8. And they sure enough did lip service to acknowledge that they heard those arguments, but they didn't demonstrate that they really listened to those arguments. And so, for example, the court identified, and this is Judge Reinhold's decision for the Ninth Circuit, he recognized that proponents of Proposition 8 believe that Proposition 8 would further California's interest in child rearing and procreation, that Proposition 8 would protect religious freedom, that it would prevent children from being taught about same-sex marriage in schools and so forth. But then when he went through each of those one by one to show that none of them really substantiate any rational basis, he, much like Judge Walker before him, was rather selective in the way he read the material that was before the court and quoted things out of context as well.
You actually have an example, and this is from the context of my denomination, a document that was produced by the president's office of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod some years back, in a series called What About? And this one had to do with homosexuality. I understand that it was actually read out as by those who were opposing Prop 8 as an example of religious bigotry.
Yes, that's correct. And so this goes back to the district court case of a couple years ago in Judge Walker's courtroom. And in Judge Walker's decision, he writes as follows: religious beliefs that gays and lesbians in their relationships are sinful or inferior to heterosexual relationships, those beliefs harm gays and lesbians. And then he cites, I'm looking at it here, it goes on for three pages of examples. We've got Catholics, we've got Mormons, and then it comes to the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. And he quotes the following from Al Berry's tract, What About Homosexuality? The Lord teaches us through his word that homosexuality is a sinful distortion of his desire that one man and one woman live together in marriage as husband and wife. And that's the entire quote as it appears here. However, the entire document was presented as a plaintiff's brief, or rather plaintiff's exhibit in the case. And that's also as part of the court record. When you read the entire document, you find that immediately around that judgment against homosexuality are also judgments against other sins, including heterosexual unchastity. So clearly there's no distinction in the Missouri Synod between heterosexual and homosexual unchastity. Both are regarded as sinful. Furthermore, the document goes on to emphasize forgiveness in Christ, reconciliation with the church, and so forth. And so the overall tone that Alberry has is one that is positive and affirming. But that context is expressly removed in the way that this is presented here.
I guess what I'm wondering is, I mean, it sounds as though at least those who were opposed to Prop 8 kind of just went cherry-picking for what they thought could be the most, or what they thought would be the most egregious examples of religious opposition to Prop 8. I take it that Prop 8, when it was being argued before the people, when it was being voted on by people, was being voted by all different citizens, not necessarily Lutherans or Catholics or Mormons. Their decision-making process could hardly have been chalked up to reading Dr. Al Berry's one statement on homosexuality.
That is correct. And I'll give another example that shows precisely how there were concerns distinct from religion. There were concerns about education. And this also was part of evidence. It was before Judge Walker. We know that he had the document because he quoted from it. The problem, again, is that he quoted selectively and thereby distorted the meaning. And the problem is that the Ninth Circuit, although it was asked to correct that error of the lower court, did not do so, but rather perpetuated it. So let me give you an example. We have the court quoting from those who designed the advertising campaign, the video advertising campaign in favor of Proposition 8. And the judge quotes selectively from their own document in which the campaign ad designer said, "We strongly believe that a campaign in favor of traditional marriage would not be enough to prevail, so we looked around, et cetera, to find other things." But what he does not include is when they say the following: "We settled on three broad areas where this conflict of rights was most likely to occur: religious freedom, freedom of expression, and in how this new fundamental right would be inculcated in young children through the public schools. And we made sure," listen carefully to this last part, "we made sure that we had very concrete examples we could share with voters of things that had actually occurred." And it turns out that their video campaign and other material, pamphlets and so forth, used actual historical examples from Massachusetts, where same-sex marriage already had been legalized, and from California, where it had briefly been legal during a brief time, examples of what was happening for children as young as kindergarten who were being required against the wishes of their parents to learn that same-sex marriage was just as good as traditional marriage. And the court completely ignored those examples. It did not discuss them. It did not try to refute them. It simply overlooked them. And the Ninth Circuit failed to correct that.
Dr. Ryan McPherson is our guest. He's chair of the History Department at Bethany Lutheran College in Mankato, Minnesota. We're talking about legal issues surrounding Prop 8, its opposition, and its support. It's Monday afternoon, February the 13th. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc.
Educating a new generation of Lutherans, you're listening to Issues Etc.
What are church elders responsible for? How can we build trust between pastors and elders? And how can we hold one another accountable? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February is titled Pastors and Elders, Caring for the Church and One Another. You can check it out at issuesetc.org, or you can purchase Pastors and Elders by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, Pastors and Elders.
Have you heard of the CLCC? In Hosea 4, we see, "My people are destroyed by lack of knowledge." The Confessional Lutherans for Christ Commission can help educate Lutherans on being Lutheran. We treasure our Lutheran beliefs and think that all Lutherans would if they learn what we believe, teach, and confess. So visit our website, www.theclcc.org. Check out what we have to offer. Get on our mailing list, or better yet, join us. And maybe encourage your pastor to hold a seminar in your area. Just go to theclcc.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Ryan McPherson is our guest. We're talking about legal issues surrounding Prop 8. Sounds like from what you said before the break, there's really an additional thing to consider here, and that is parental freedom in directing the education of their kids.
Yes, that's correct. In California, as well as elsewhere in the nation, there is an incremental strategy underway that involves not only the legalization of same-sex marriage, but also a transformation of the public school curricula. And not only that, but there also are articles one can find in law review journals in which lawyers already have rehearsed what they believe will be constitutional arguments in favor of requiring the private schools and also homeschoolers be required to teach respect for same-sex marriage on par with the marriage between a man and a woman.
Any idea what those arguments would sound like?
Well, generally, the argument goes something like this, that men and women should be treated equally, and so should gays and lesbians, and therefore we need to be very suspicious of anyone who teaches that the roles of husbands are different than the roles of wives, or that marriage requires one husband and one wife rather than two husbands or two wives, and that anyone who promotes those kinds of differences would be promoting some sort of form of inequality that is fundamentally contrary to the convictions of our nation, and therefore essentially a young girl or a homosexual boy or whatever the case may be could be seen as being denied a fundamental right to an education because they're basically told that there's something wrong with their behavior and so forth. That's essentially the way the argument goes.
Okay, let's talk about the implications of this decision as it stands now for religious liberty in general.
Well, as it stands now, it unfortunately has a chilling effect on religious liberty and on freedom of speech in general. And that's because Judge Walker's decision from a year and a half ago in the district court said that the proponents failed to identify any rational basis that Proposition 8 could conceivably advance. That's a quotation. Here's another one. Nothing more than fear or unarticulated dislike could account for it. And then finally he says, quote, moral and religious views form the only basis for a belief that same-sex couples are different from opposite-sex couples, end quote. And with language like that and peppering his whole order with words such as bigotry and animus that he ascribes to the proponents for Proposition 8, he has essentially branded the view that only marriage between a man and a woman is valid or recognized in California as being a view that cannot be accepted in the public square, as being a view that is so at odds with civilization that it cannot be tolerated. And for the Ninth Circuit not to correct that puts us on a dangerous path. Now, to be sure, the First Amendment right for freedom of religion and free speech remains. But nonetheless, I think people are going to be more nervous about expressing their views than they used to be.
If it is not overturned, if the court, the Supreme Court, decides not to hear the case, or if they hear it and they decide inexplicably to uphold the lower decision, what do you think the result will be?
Well, that's difficult to say because the position that the court has taken for the Ninth Circuit is somewhat narrowly tailored given the unique circumstances in California. In California, we had the situation that marriage was briefly permitted among homosexual couples, and some 18,000 of them became married during that interval. So the question is, since California allowed it briefly, and now no longer allows it under Proposition 8, it appears that they did not merely disallow the expansion of a right, but rather that they took away a right that already existed. And that was part of the argument that the Ninth Circuit had in its ruling. Other states have other situations where they've never allowed it, and then they went on record not only in their laws, which have been around for a while, but more recently through constitutional amendments. So we have 63 million voters spread throughout 31 states who have weighed in on this, and 63% of them have been in favor of traditional marriage. And so in those states, there's a chance that the logic of the Ninth Circuit may not necessarily carry over. And just to give an example, I have here a case. This one's out of New York, Hernandez versus Robles from several years ago. And And here they have a very different tone than what we find in the Ninth Circuit. It says this: the traditional definition of marriage is not merely a byproduct of historical injustice. Its history is of a different kind. The idea that same-sex marriage is even possible is a relatively new one. Until a few decades ago, it was an accepted truth for almost everyone, whoever lived, in any society in which marriage existed, that there could be marriage only between participants of different sex. A court should not lightly conclude that everyone who held this belief was irrational, ignorant, or bigoted. And we do not so conclude. So in other jurisdictions, there has been a different tone, and that's why it's possible the Supreme Court will reverse the Ninth Circuit, or even if it upholds the Ninth Circuit, it might somehow limit its impact so that it won't touch other states so directly.
You were the principal author of an amicus brief in these proceedings. With about a minute and a half here, give us a summary of what you said to the court in favor of Proposition 8.
Sure. We essentially argued that the proponents for Proposition 8 had a rational basis, and that their rational basis was the long-recognized right of parents to exercise control over their children's education. And so this brief began going back over a century to show that the Supreme Court of the United States has long recognized that parents have a fundamental right to determine their children's education. And then we argued that the campaign for Proposition 8 was essentially presented in a way that was trying to protect parents' rights so that they could determine what their children learned about marriage and family in the school system. And it's interesting to note that Proposition 8, the campaign was underway during this awkward window of time when a California appellate court had briefly declared homeschooling illegal in California. And so we believe that parents had rational reasons to think that Proposition 8, by clarifying the definition of marriage, would clarify what California law meant when it requires teachers in public schools to teach about marriage and to teach the value of marriage. And so that was essentially our argument, and we also identified some an incremental strategy among the advocates for same-sex marriage, demonstrating that it's not just about marriage, it's about the family more broadly, and it's about the education of future generations.
Real briefly, about 30 seconds, what do you think that strategy is with regard to family more broadly?
Well, I think it tends to be a loosening of ties between husband and wife and parent and child, and a strengthening of ties between the individual and the state, be it through employment regulations, be it through public education or other means. And it may well be well-intended. There's a lot of talk about liberty, let people be free to marry whom they choose. There's a lot of talk about equality, treat people the same, and no matter what kind of couple they are. But unfortunately, the reality is that the more the state encroaches into the domain of the home, the less liberty any of us have. And that is one of the concerns that was articulated in our brief.
You're president of the Hausvater Project. Tell us about it.
Sure. Well, the name Hausvater comes from Luther's small catechism, and he prefaces each section with the phrase of the head of household or the father or the Hausvater in German shall teach it to his family. And so we encourage fathers and mothers to take an active and primary role in the Christian upbringing of their children as they work together with their pastors and their congregations.
Dr. Ryan McPherson is chairman of the department, the history department at Bethany Lutheran Church in Mankato, Minnesota. He's president of the Hausvater Project, and he wrote a friend of the court brief for Prop 8 on behalf of the Hausvater Project. We'll have a link to the Hausvater Project at our website, issuesetc.org. Dr. McPherson, thank you very much for being our guest.
And thank you, Todd.
This is something that I think should concern everybody. And I agree that the implications for religious liberty are chilling. This is one subject. This is one issue. Think about that. Just the issue of marriage. Now, it's a big one. It's a huge one, but it's still just one. And if the court were to decide that opposition to, for example, same-sex marriage has no rational basis, legally speaking, and can only come from religious bigotry or fear or unexpressed dislike, what other teachings of your religion, regardless of what your religion may be, might in the future be deemed intolerable in the public square? This is the big one. This is the one that encompasses so much of our lives because it has to do with father, mother, family, children, marriage. But there are other issues, too, that might be considered, well, bigoted without any rational basis and intolerable in the public square. I think religious liberty here is on the line. When we come back on this Monday afternoon, we're going to be talking with Deaconess Pam Nielsen. One of the biggest events before the crucifixion and the resurrection was witnessed by only a few. Three, to be exact. Jesus takes his disciples, Peter, James, and John, to a mountain, and he is transfigured right before them. His flesh shines like the sun, and he appears with Moses and Elijah. Why such a big event in such a small audience? And why does Jesus, when it's all said and done, tell his disciples to keep it a secret? Wouldn't you think he'd want something like that? Him appearing in divine glory to be known far and wide? We'll answer that question with Deaconess Pam Nielsen as we talk about the Transfiguration after this.
No gimmicks, no shticks, just straightforward preaching and teaching in accord with Scripture and the Lutheran confessions. By the book liturgy, right from the hymnal. No glitz, just Christ crucified for sinners like us. We're Grace Lutheran Church in Racine, Wisconsin. Come receive God's gifts with us. Find out more about us at GraceLutheranRacine, that's all one word, .net. And like you, we're proud supporters of Issues Etc.
Did you know that you can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by donating stocks, bonds, and mutual funds to Lutheran Public Radio? For more information, contact Craig at 618-223-8382, 618-223-8382. Please consider donating stocks, bonds, or mutual funds to Issues Etc. this year. Call Craig today, 618-223-8382. Thanks for your support.
We love our on-demand listeners. You're listening to Issues Etc.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
Pro-abortion activists are once again trotting out a decades-old and flawed study that says abortion is safer than childbirth. This study shows you can make statistics say basically anything you want. Here's how they did it. They didn't include the longer-term risks for women who abort their babies. The study also doesn't account for abortion's physical damage done on women, nor does it take into account many deaths due to abortion that are attributed to other causes because of the stigma surrounding abortion. In countries where abortion isn't legal, such as Ireland, maternal mortality after birth is consistently low, and in countries with liberal abortion laws, it's consistently high. So don't believe the pro-abortion propaganda that abortion's safer than childbirth. Choosing life is much safer.
Check out Life Issues on Facebook and stay more informed than you've ever been.